My name is Daniel Su. I'm here with Ms. Gail Teixeira in Georgetown, Guyana on the 20th of May 2009. Mr. Teixeira, thanks very much for agreeing to meet and agreeing to the recorded part of the conversation. I understand that you have many demands on your time, so I do appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. I told you a little bit about our project, and you shared some very interesting reflections on the Guyana constitutional reform process. And you were just getting to your time as Minister of Home Affairs.
Yeah.
And I understand you were minister during a particularly difficult time.
Yes.
In the country when the security situation was under a lot of scrutiny and a lot of public pressure, public demands for things to be done. And I was wondering if you could just reflect a little bit on going into this position at this particular time and what you felt your priorities were and your immediate needs.
Okay. I think in the beginning, let me just do a preamble on that.
Sure.
Is that I think we have to put Guyana in the context. By the time I became acting Minister of Home Affairs in 2004 and then Minister of Home Affairs from 2005 to 2006 elections, prior to that, I think that Guyana has to be recognized that the first free and fair elections in 92, we took over a country where the treasury was empty, basically, and that our first priority was trying to reconstruct the country. So if you look at Guyana, what we did as a government between 92 and 99, basically, was trying to reconstruct the education sector, the health sector, try to get funding for water and housing, which were in terrible conditions. There was no housing program, so a lot of people had no place to live, or we had 20 people living in one small home. The poverty levels were 67% of the people were living below the poverty line in 1991. Today it is 35% are living below the poverty line, and 18% of that are what you call extreme poverty or serious poverty. So that you have to look at what we end up doing when I become Minister of Home Affairs in that context, in that we came in as a government of pro-poor, that poverty reduction programs, and trying to improve the quality of life of our people. We had only about 75% of children went to primary school, and about 40% of the kids went to secondary school. So a lot of our interventions in the beginning were social services, health sector, education, trying to get water where water was already supposed to be there to be working and to be relatively clean and to start expanding, looking for money to go further afield, to try to put the productive areas of Guyana back into operation because you needed money. So the sugar sector was in bad condition, rice sector, gold mining, etc., all the area, bauxite, all the areas that didn't bring us, couldn't bring the kind of revenue we wanted, including corruption and trying to reduce corruption so we could include revenue generation. So you also have between 97 and 2002 a period of a lot of violence in the country, political violence, post-97 elections and post-201 elections. So it's a very unstable political situation and socially unstable. You then have in 2002 the breakout of the prison. And what happens after that is that these criminals are validated by the political opposition as freedom fighters. So they go and occupy. Now, most of these chaps were not from the village of Buxton, but they occupied that. They seized it and occupied it, and they really occupied the territory from 2002 until 2008. The gang then that was formed by these five prisoners who had escaped and bringing together other gang leaders and other criminal, very serious criminal elements, posed a serious challenge to the police and security forces. What made it more difficult is that the opposition said, call them freedom fighters. The then former president of Guyana, Mr. Hoyt, and leader of the opposition party, leader of the opposition, went into Buxton and called them kith and kin, and that they were fighting for the liberation of Guyana. It then made the situation more and more peers, it was Afro-Guyanese gangs and Afro-Guyanese opposition against an Indo-Guyanese other ethnic group and a government that was not majority Indian, but certainly had a very large Indian base. So it was extremely, it wasn't just a criminal gang running around with AK-47s. They were highly armed, and the death toll is estimated of over 200 people that they killed. They did execution-type killings and so on. The police tried to deal with it, and first of all, the first visual thing was that the police had small caliber revolvers, and they were meeting rapid-fire weapons. The police were chased out of the area and unable to manage it. The army was then called in. The army had, at that time, certain dual loyalties of an ethnic ground, a class background, and they themselves felt that armies don't deal with civilian issues. They deal with borders and border security and stuff like that. But this issue of dealing with a village in Guyana that was under siege was not part of their mandate. In addition to that, the gangs then recruited young boys who were in school from the village, young 14, 15-year-old boys that were impressionable with these guys walking around with guns and police couldn't handle them, recruited many of them to their forces. The village was also had dual loyalties, but they were... So anybody in the village who cooperated with the police or security forces were executed. Houses were burnt, people were beheaded, etc. The government approached friendly governments, the British, the Americans, the Canadians, to assist. The only country that at that time responded in a way was the British. And so I think you may have seen the Simmons Report. Mm-hmm. That comes out of that era. The British at that time also assisted with training with a rapid deployment group. Not a SWAT exactly, but a rapid deployment unit. Regrettably, that unit had to be disbanded before I came in because it was infiltrated by the drug barons. So you have a criminal gang and you have the drug barons. The drug barons and the criminal gangs have an interesting synergy between the two of them in that supplies came from various places, including from time to time from the drug guys. And that area, there are many issues that can't be written about as yet, mm-hmm. as they're not, some of the things haven't even fructified or, confirmed. Mm-hmm. So that the then Minister of Home Affairs was accused by the opposition of extrajudicial killings. The government then set up a presidential commission of inquiry, which met from 2003 into 2005, hearing evidence by parties, by individuals, etc. So in the meantime, the minister was released from his position. I then was appointed to act. So he was given leave to come off, and so I then took on basically just to be the holding force while the presidential commission was going on. However, the crime wave continued. So the issues that were still critical for the government was that you had to deal with the criminal activity. And so a number of interventions were started. The original forays by the government with the donor community, these are the IFIs, in the 2003, 2004, 2004 period, brought nothing to the table. They all said, we don't get involved with police reform, we don't get involved with modernization of police forces. By the end of 2004, the government was able to get the IDB to agree to an approach to do with modernization of the police force, because it was recognized by then that it wasn't just arming police, it was training police, that there were structural and systemic impediments to police reform. One of them being that the our police force is modeled on the old British colonial police organizational structure, administration, management, etc. And that this model was in fact not one that lent itself to reform easily. It was very hierarchical, and it had so many ranks. And so two things happened. One was with the IDB, what was called the Citizen Security Project, we had an aid memoir in by 2005 September, and we started designing the Citizen Security Project. The IDB wanted very clearly the community police relations and stuff like that, and we did a very interesting baseline survey, which I think is excellent, and IDB has copies of it, which looked at two regions of Ghana which had the highest crime waves, Region 4 and Region 6. That would be Berbice and the Demerara region where we are now. And did a survey with over 2,000 people based on the gender demographics, ethnic demographics of Guyana using the 2002 census. And so that document was called Realizing Safe Neighborhoods. They asked questions about the people's national view of the army, police, prison, fire from a national point of view. And basically these institutions got about a C+, about 65%, somewhere in there. But when the question switched to asking about the police in the neighborhood, that's when the statistics changed dramatically. Clearly, the face of the policeman that they interact with all the time, the sergeant and corporal, the lower ranks, was where you had the greatest criticisms, lack of response, unfriendly attitudes, sometimes collusion with elements that were in the communities that may be antisocial, even bending to illegal activity. And so that was the next part of the survey. The third part of the survey was saying, based on the crime wave, have you changed your lifestyle? You know, have you stopped going out to parties? Have you changed your abode where you live? You know, do you go out late at night anymore? And interestingly enough, there wasn't a radical change in that, despite the media hyping up and the media in conveying that, you know, hell break loose, that the whole country was in chaos and people being gunned down all over the place. So that, ironically, in the two regions where you had the most crimes and the worst crimes, that people felt insecure, but they were not making radical changes in their lifestyles. There was a change, but it wasn't a radical movement. They also asked questions to the persons being interviewed of their attitudes to domestic violence, to interpersonal violence, a range of areas like that, drugs and so on. And again, there were issues that came out. So that has formed the baseline in terms of opinions in relation to where the weak areas of the police sector in particularly, that a lot of attention had to be paid at the lower levels of the police force in terms of training, reconstruction of police stations so that you would have places for witnesses to give evidence, the two-way mirrors for witnesses to identify, and so on. So in the first, what was called the pre-feasibility study, we were able to build two new police stations that incorporated some of these issues. For example, the identification room allowed for two-way mirrors and the special room for rape victims, domestic violence or where you had a witness you had to sequester. Mm-hmm. Because the old stations were built in the old model, and most of the stations went back 40, 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. These were open police stations. So when you're questioning a witness, the whole group, and you know some of the stations are very tiny, so they might be a little bigger than this room. So if I'm questioning someone who's giving information on a gang member who's being harbored by a neighbor, everybody in the station can hear it. And so the issue of the confidence of the informant or the person bringing information in was a serious problem in the crime wave. That people had information, but they didn't know how to relay it. So the area of trying to acquire major financial resources to be able to bring structural and systemic changes in the police force and a new approach to community relations, that began in the design phase in the 205-206. It was also recognized that you need legislative changes. Oh, excuse me, Parliament takes up a lot of my time.
Sure, yeah. No problem.
Yeah. Yes, go ahead.
Thanks. This is part two of the interview.
I don't know if this is what you you're looking for.
No, absolutely. This sort of the outline of the process is very helpful, actually.
Yeah. So we were able to with the pre-feasibility study to do a lot of the design conceptualization of the citizen security project with the IDP, and we went through many stages. In fact, I'll just give you a small thing. That is that in the beginning, the IDP did not want major infrastructure work to do with the stations, the police stations. And we went through quite a long process with the IDB in which we successfully were able to increase the amount of the loan and to include the remodeling of police stations, to incorporate these areas that I spoke about earlier. To include the construction of a new training school for the police or training academy for the police, because we recognized we needed better facilities, more modern facilities, and so forth. And the community action part was one that both the IDB and the government felt were important in terms of trying to build confidence between the police force and the community, as that was the only way we would be able to reduce crime and have better crime prevention by having a community that had confidence in the police force. Mm-hmm. So that was at the IFI level, the big donor level, where in 2007 we signed the loan. I was no longer there, but we signed the loan, which was a $20 million loan for 2006 to 2011 with the IDB. So that project is going on, and I'm sure Minister Rohi and his group have spoken to you about that.
Yeah.
At the other end of the donor area, there were discussions that started with the British about assistance to the police force. And the Scottish Police were part of both the IDB conceptualizing design phase and what were some of the different interests in relation to the security forces. The government also recognized, but it wasn't strictly Home Affairs, but it was a recognition between the security sector, rule of law, etc., that we couldn't only modernize the security sector and the police force, we had to modernize the justice sector and the criminal justice sector. And so simultaneously, as we were dealing with the IDB in 2005, 2006, we were also dealing with the judiciary. And so you have a justice sector project, which is $25 million, that began in that same 2005, 2006 area in terms of design and conceptualization, which recognized a number of things that the police complained about, because the police were part of this consultation in the CSP. It wasn't just, you know, people sitting there and saying what we needed to do and people coming in with their templates from overseas. So a lot of things that were proposed to us were rejected as inoperable in our context. But the two projects are married, and important that they both work, in that the backlog of the criminal justice system, criminal cases and civil cases, to build confidence of the public in law and order, one had to do both together. If we had gone on the track of just dealing with police as crime fighting, we would have ended up losing confidence in the courts, because by 2005, people were saying, and the media was championing it, that people got to take the law into their own hands, because when these criminals are apprehended, the courts are giving them bail. And so they're back on the street, and they go back and shoot another person, or they go and rob another place. And so more and more the civilian population was feeling very frightened that, one, the police were having difficulties managing, the GDF was also not showing great capacity, and at the same time you had a judicial system that worked at best very, very slowly, and which seemed to be arbitrary in its judgments. And so you have a population with the media hype, and any study of this period has to examine not only the home affairs and the security sector, must examine what the media did in this period. The media played several roles, one of which was to point out and to constantly bash the security forces for ineptitude, for incompetence, even when they did do things that were right. If they did in a shootout with the criminals, they were then accused of being abusive force, even when the criminals had AK-47 shooting at the police force. So the police were being hammered, bashed. You had the government being bashed, because it was said that we weren't able to provide public safety for our population. You had an opposition that attacked the police force and accused them of being loyal to the government and attacking Afro-Guyanese. So it was an extremely traumatic period where you basically walked between the raindrops and prayed that the raindrops were far apart and to keep things in balance. So at the government level, there were a number of initiatives. While you started with the IDB thing, were the other issues to try and bring some immediate turnarounds bring some confidence to both the police force and to the general population. One was immediately spending quite a large amount of money in improving the equipment of the police force. And this included vehicles, some armored vehicles, because when the police were shot at, they were shot at with AK-47s, not .38 and not 9mm. So you had to, in some cases, have armored vehicles. You had more police vehicles, because the police didn't have a lot of vehicles. Because, as I said, when we started out, the emphasis was on the population, of improving the conditions of life of our people. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the security sector was getting more money than it ever did before, but probably not as much in retrospect that it needed, had we known that 2002 would have occurred. So we gave them much more. We did a lot of work in the police force that had never been done for decades, but it was not in terms of the percentage of the budget going to them versus water, health, housing, roads, electricity, blah, blah, blah. That was a smaller percentage. So that vehicles, armored vehicles, radio equipment, better radio equipment, bulletproof vests of a higher caliber than what they had been using. Many of the police in the beginning did not have bulletproof vests. So those were simple interventions. These were not... we weren't bringing in high-powered, high-tech stuff. These are things that would be considered rudimentary in the United States for a policeman. Improving the caliber of weapons they were able to use. And this is where, of course, then with the British training that we had in the 2005-2006 period to help our police to know how to manage mobs, public order training, in anticipation of the elections, that the British, for example, didn't want us using MP3 weapons. They wanted us to use a different type of weapon. Or And then we couldn't get approval from Europe to bring in the weapons. So I may be getting the weapon wrong, but I think it's MP3s. So anecdotally, they insisted on the training having, the MP3s. But we had to get waivers from the Europeans and the British to allow us to import the weapons, because it was a German manufacturer or whatever, with a British subsidiary. We never got the waiver. Never. Even though we paid, you had to pay, blah, blah, blah. Jamaica had exactly the same experience. The difference between Jamaica and Guyana is that they paid a whole set of money, never got the waiver and lost their money. Guyana decided after that we were not putting money up front. We were waiting for a waiver then. But we had the money holding, but we didn't hand it over. But it was in our embassy. And so we had British training, which was very useful to our police. This was an immediate intervention, and we appreciate what the British did for us and the trainers, because they allowed our police for the first time to have proper training in hostage taking, and in public order training, mob training, riots and stuff like that. And I saw some of the demonstrations as a minister in the simulations they did to show if a house was occupied by criminals, how to handle it, to surround, blah, 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 which our policemen did not have that training. That was formally seen that GDF do those kind of anti-guerrilla type activities. These were our police being trained in basically urban guerrilla, urban anti-guerrilla type training, which the police had never been trained for in our country whatsoever. So that, and a lot of these trainings were joint forces training, that is army and police, not just police alone. Because we have a small army and we have a small police force. We're not a huge, neither are large. So that was one intervention, the budgetary increase in the type of equipment coming in, a lot of money on radio equipment so that stations would be equipped, cars would be equipped, and so on. And the third area was now the community interventions where we spent money. Two things we did was that the layout of the divisions of the police force, as I said, based on the old British divisions, colonial times. The country has changed, the country has moved, populations have moved. And you had some very strange divisions. So that the police stations had few people in them in some areas. So what we did, we found that recruitment in the police force in the crime wave was very low. People just didn't want their sons and daughters to become police when guys are coming at them with AK-47s, including a statistic which was publicly known and not hidden, was that between the formation of the Guyana Police Force, or the British Guyana Police Force in 1865 to 2002, 10 policemen were killed in action. From 2002 to 2008, the number went up to 30-odd. So what happened in the recruitment period is the recruitment into the police force dropped. And so to try to augment that, we then developed what was called the neighborhood police. Neighborhood police were residentially based, community-based citizens between the ages of 18 and 50 who may not have all the qualifications to get into the police force, who may have been rural constables or just civic-minded citizens who didn't mind playing this role as a community-based rural constable, but now with a police uniform on, but who would live in the community, knew the community, and would be one, an informant, an information person who could provide information on strange activities, but who could also be the peace officer in the community. You have domestic violence, you have drunk men having fights, or in some of the rural areas, people fighting over the pig going in their yard and eating up their flowers. These are parochial and rather robust irritants in the communities. The cows go and eat the rice farmers' produce in the field, so it's big dispute in the community. So we recruited and then started training. We set a goal of 600 neighborhood police around the country, and the program started in my time and we were able, we had money released, we had training programs, uniforms, and so forth, and those people are still in the system. And we trained approximately about 100 in the 2006 period. They were very critical when we came to the election period at the polling stations, being supplementary security at the police stations with the police and so forth.
They're armed?
No.
Not armed?
They are not armed. They are not armed in the main. They have their baton, they have their little precepts and stuff like that. They work under the direction of the nearest station and the commander of that station. They are not free agents on their own. They report to the police station, they're given duties, and they are in contact. They're given cell phones to be in contact with the station, reporting and stuff like that.
But they're paid? And
yes, they're paid. Yeah. And they're ranked. They're the level of a rural constable. Okay. If any of them, and they're residential. So if neighborhood police decides, I don't want to live in this village anymore, I want to go live somewhere else, mm-hmm. he can no longer be the neighborhood police for that village. So if he moves to a village or an area where there's no neighborhood police, he may be considered, but the community has to validate the neighborhood police. The neighborhood police is validated if a name goes up or someone mm-hmm. applies to be a neighborhood police. Mm-hmm. The community has to say, yes, he's a good man, he doesn't drink, he doesn't behave bad, he doesn't beat his wife. And so how it is done is through the local government organ, by the religious people, if there's a women's group or whatever, they would say, no, this is a good man. If he tells us to listen to him, we will listen to him. But some names may go up and say, no, we'll never listen to him because he's telling us to do things that he doesn't obey. So this was a very innovative residential-based policeman, but a community, what we call community-based policeman. They don't have, if they want to have promotional opportunities in the police force, then they have to enter in a more formal way and go into the police training school. But if they're 50 years old and he's retired and he wants to just do that for the next 10 years and he's a good man and that's what he stays at that level. So you can have rural constables, you can be a rural constable, you can go to the level of a corporal, mm-hmm. but you can't go higher than that, okay. right, in that area. So that was one innovation. The second innovation, which had existed since the 70s, were what was called community policing groups, which has had a interesting history, and that will need to be written one day. It was started in the former government, the PNC days. Basically, it began because of crime waves, not at this level, but break-in entries and banditry and stuff like that. And it was a way of trying to mobilize communities to protect themselves. It was had a colored history in the sense it was, yes, it started out with very good intentions. It became then more arms of the PNC under the dictatorial period of the PNC regime. However, there were people who became rural constables, were trained, and many of them tried to be professional in their outlook with the community. When in the 90s, in the 2002 period, we then tried to encourage the formation of community policing groups all over the country. In the haste to do so, there were sometimes accusations of them acting outside of the police force or not with the police force, put it that way more accurately. So in 2004, what we did was try to work with the community policing groups and the police as partners. So that was the shift. It wasn't that the community policing groups were disbanded and restarted. What we tried to do was work with the groups that were in existence. We had on record 3,000 members of community policing groups, with about 300 groups. But that was on paper.
Okay.
That was on paper. When we went down to the ground between 2004 to 2006, probably there were 100 groups operating with 10 persons each. By the way, you had women in these groups as well. Not a majority, not a big group, but even you had one or two groups where women had headed a community policing group. Mm-hmm. Now, the community policing group is voluntary. They're not paid. They assist the police force in patrolling, providing information, if there's a problem in a village, calling out the police force, and they may be the first call. They, as I said, patrol at night, where in villages where a police station may cover about 10 villages, and that may be a radius of 20 miles. The police in 205, 206 didn't have many vehicles, so they themselves couldn't patrol. So you have someone's broken into someone's house. In some cases, not everywhere had phones either. So how do they know? So there was the attempt to try to improve timeliness of police response, and the first call would be the community policing group. And so we went on a campaign to encourage communities to be part of crime prevention. Number one, crime prevention by being part of the noticing of strange vehicles if places were being stalked, strange persons coming in the village, as well as patrolling. And to try to build the community confidence in the police force, to develop a partnership between the police in the station and the police, the people in the community. And so if they saw them working together, it would enhance a feeling of confidence that there were greater possibilities. The community policing groups in 2000 to 2003 wanted weapons, and this was a problem from the police point of view. So in the 2005-2006 period, what was done was that members of the police force, the community policing groups that were rural constables, or who were being trained as rural constables and had acquired their precepts as rural constables, would then be issued with a weapon for the community policing group. But there was a limit of how many weapons for each group. And they could only be held by the rural constable and or if there was a licensed firearm member who was a member of the group. So a man might be a member of the community policing group. He's a businessman. He's been able to get a weapon. Mm-hmm. Therefore, that is part of the group's strength. A farmer might belong to a group, and farmers in this country do have weapons because sometimes jaguars go and eat their crop or whatever. So this is our reality. Yeah. So that they may have a rifle or whatever. Okay. So that was to supplement those kind of things. We provided vehicles. So the state gave them a vehicle which they had to maintain. The vehicle had to be kept with the police force, and when they went on patrol, they then picked up the vehicle. The police force provided the gasoline for the use, but the vehicle was not to be used for personal purposes whatsoever. So the vehicle could only be used in the line of duty, a voluntary duty, that is, at the time. We also provided boats. And so you may have seen in yesterday's paper, the other paper, the minister handing over boats, because we're a riverine country. And we found in the crime wave of 2002 to 2008 that these vast areas of Guyana that are unoccupied or sparsely occupied became havens for when the gangs had to run into the interior to hide from the police, that they were able to get into areas of country which the police found difficulties to get into. So did the community policing groups. So vehicles in some of the interior areas, we gave them ATVs. A few of those were given over because we were now going into this new area. So those were some of the kind of interventions. A lot of community meetings were held in the 2004-2006 period where people carried on, they cursed, they ventilated, and then you got down, you let them ventilate about their fears, their anger, their whatever, and then you tried to then hone that into a view, okay, what can we do? We, public partner, private, police, citizen, and so on, hone that into a view that this problem is all of ours, and to what can we do? And so that was a strategy that was used. You went to meetings and boy did you get told off. And you had the commander with you, the police commander with you of the division and some of the police officers with you. And you allowed for the dialogue to take place between the community and the police so that community people would get up and quarrel. The police didn't give them a weapon or whatever and the police would respond and stuff like that. So it was also a form to make the police more sensitive to the views of the community. So these were kind of what you call immediate interventions we made to try to also manage the situation, and to bring some, because we did have in 2005, what made us realize how delicate the situation was that in 2005 you had some what I called spontaneous community eruptions, where in Port Morant, for example, in November 2005, there was a shooting incident. The police took a long time to get there. Certain elements in the community, hotheads, got together, led the community in mass. 300, 400 people set the road on fire with tires and stuff like that. And we had to go in and negotiate and so forth and so on. And there were a couple other things like that. They put tires on the road and the main road, because I think you know by now, Guyana has a number of main arteries mm-hmm. that the village spin off. So all you have to do is block a road, and that blocks transport for 60 to 100 miles or more. You just blockade a country, basically. And so a lot of my time was spent outing fires, and that meant negotiating with communities, assuaging fears, and going through a lot of negotiations, mediation with communities to sometimes separate the most extreme from the less extreme, the more moderates, and so on. And of course, in a number of these communities, there was political interventions, political activities behind the scene, which sometimes guys gave cartons and cartons of beer. Mm-hmm. So by the time you got there, you were dealing with a whole set of drunk men who were pelting bottles at police. And they didn't use weapons, but there were very tense times, and you had to deal with the police and the community at the same time. In only one instant, after negotiating, reaching agreements on everything and a way forward, and an agreement to clear the road, stop the fires, and stuff like that, the next morning, an extremist group took over and came back out on the police force after we'd cleared the road, brought in all the heavy equipment too, and the road was badly damaged. They came back out, and I gave the order to use more force. And that was when we used what you call rubber bullets. No one was killed, and no one was injured, but it cleared the road. And that was in an area that was sympathetic to my government. It was not an area hostile to my government. It was people who vote for us. But I felt the nation was watching, in that if we couldn't control that situation, the areas that were hostile to us, well, as we say in Creole, cat eat your dinner, you know, that was going to be the end of it. So I had to show an even hand, and that I was prepared, once law and order reached a certain point, that I was prepared to give the police an order to deal with the situation. And so That was the only time that I used that kind of intervention. A lot of the other spontaneous eruptions, you had to go and negotiate. They would eventually clear the road. They would obey the police after, but they cuss and, you know, they had to get their ventilation out. So we also had at that time what must not be forgotten. And I'm sorry to take you through all this history.
No, this is great. This is really good.
And that is that, as if the crime wave wasn't enough, as if the preparation for 2006 elections wasn't enough, as if the normal government program wasn't enough, December 2005, we then were faced with the floods and the national disaster, where 300,000 people were flooded out of a population of 700,000 along the coast. And so in the midst of that, you had criminal activity. It quelled down a little bit because they were flooded out as we were flooded out. But then the political hype began, because then the opposition forces tried to make the political issues about the response to the disaster. This little tiny poor country of ours, in 24 hours of, because we had rain from January 17, the rains had started in the Christmas period. You had had some flooding, the water went down. January had started back again. And then from January 17, the rain rained for days. And water just had nowhere to go. And so within 24 hours to 48 hours, the government response of bringing food to people, of trying to get people to evacuate where necessary, of moving people to the schools and trying to have emergency responses. We had never as a country ever dealt with anything of this magnitude. The civil society, army, police. So the police were completely diverted now into public order issues and you know, people lining up to get food and rice and food to eat and water, fresh water and stuff like that. The army and so on were now into a different mode. And the so from then until February 28th, 2005, we were under extreme pressure. The opposition tried to show that there was discrimination, but that was not so. What happened, though, and this was a good lesson for us as Guyanese, not good for the southern United States, but after all the political hype that was given and every single minister, every single elected official, member of parliament on our side, were roped in, assigned. Mm-hmm. We were out. I was in charge of Region 3, which is across the river. I was now Minister of Home Affairs, also in charge of the disaster response in Region 3. And it was in my region you had the spontaneous eruptions again. So that, which was where the hottest opposition attempt to show discrimination. And so it was interesting times, I must say. But anyway, when we looked at the Katrina, and Guyanese were left in awe to say, here we were, and this was not government people, these are ordinary people saying, you know, we criticized our government for taking 48 hours in many areas. Look what's happened in the United States, which has resources like we can't believe. I mean, we use anecdotally, in villages where they may have been near the seashore or a river, they had small boats that we could have used to get relief in and to get the elderly out and children and take fresh water in and stuff like that. But in villages which didn't have that kind of history and culture, there are funny photographs, now we can laugh about it, about abandoned fridges, you know, being used to ferry foodstuff down and ministers down to the back of villages to get relief to people and to help people and stuff. So we were innovative. These are some of the things. And interesting enough, the community policing groups came out and helped in a number of these issues of volunteers to, because we had to move supplies around the coast of Guyana, rice and all these things. And so the community policing groups, civil society, religious groups were part of that whole mass volunteer group that were involved. And as I said, you had a couple of road blockages in my region, which we negotiated and were able to make sure that people were helped and stuff like that. And then you have now the lead up to 2006 elections. And there were two more attempts to have breakouts of the prison in 2006. Mm-hmm. And then you had the robbery, Burbese robbery and stuff like that. I am quite convinced that the agenda for 2006, the political agenda for 2006, we successfully were able to undermine it with our limited resources, limited intelligence and everything else, because I think the plan was to have another set of...
This is really excellent. This is...
You know, so, I mean, it's history.
Yeah.
So that the preparations for 2006 in terms of all the British training that helped, the improvements in surveillance, improvements in electronic equipment, basically radios. We didn't have all these wiretapping things. We've now got legislation that allows for that. Equipment, again, vehicles and the armored vehicles, all these things helped to provide the police having feeling of greater security themselves. The bulletproof vests, the helmets, the visors, shields, these were all things that were acquired for the elections. So that it gave confidence to the voters that there was this image there that if anyone tried to storm a police station, a polling station or harm anybody, there was some capacity out there. And certainly, I think that the attempts that led up July, August, because they were successfully intercepted and controlled, that removed the other area, which was really to cause some mayhem on 206 elections. But outside of the strict security area, one mustn't ignore the role of the Ethnic Relations Commission in the peace meetings and the role of the interreligious organization, which was the interfaith body that brought together Hindus, Muslims, Baha'is, Rastafarians, spiritualists, and all these different religions that we have, to work with their congregations, to work with communities in having a nonviolent or peaceful 206 elections. So these were interventions at a political level. So one mustn't only see a police reform that is now in train and is moving forward in a variety of directions, that it was never seen as crime prevention, crime fighting, public safety could be dealt with strictly as a police matter, as a weapon matter or anything like that. It had to have a variety of other interventions. And the 206 elections is a perfect example, a good example, of the kind of work that was done, encouraged and supported by the government for these interventions. For example, the media monitoring unit, because I've mentioned the media a couple of times, and in 97 and 2001, the media was the force that incited people to violence and to riot. And one of the recommendations of the International Observers Mission in 201 was this media monitoring unit that had started work in 201. People didn't listen to them too much. So in 206, we had a permanent media monitoring unit that dealt with training programs for the media, responsible journalism. We also passed a racial hostility act that would, you know, prevent inciting to racial violence. And out of that whole process came what was called the media. There were two accords, the media code of conduct, that was what was the proper name, which was signed by the media houses. I think all the media houses signed that. And then there was a peace accord that was to be signed by all the political parties, that they would not resort to violence, they would not encourage violence, they would not incite racial hostilities of any kind. The parties signed it except one, and that was the People's National Congress itself. They did not sign it. And so that was an area of concern for the security forces and for, in terms of looking at preparations for the 206 elections. So the experiences, and I think that Guyana is an interesting model. We've never been seen in that. We tend to be, as Guyanese, we like to, we go to the point of criticizing ourselves so badly, and there are many things that are wrong, but we're no perfect place, but show me a perfect society, you know. I mean, but we have not sometimes trying to look for the right word, that actually is able to say that we have some good examples of things to show the world, to show the region and show the world. One I use is the constitutional reform process as a great model, and one in which the parliamentary reform, which is enshrined in the constitution, is an excellent model and sub-model. Our parliamentary reform for the Caribbean region is way in advance of any of the Caribbean countries. The level of government scrutiny, and we're trying to move in that direction more and more, and so forth. The model of how we came to our security sector reform, and we will as a government, unapologetically in a sense, say that, look, there are areas of police reform, security sector reform, that we're not going to compromise on, because ultimately we're accountable to the electorate. And so, yes, there are rights, and we will uphold the rights, but we are also not going to, play the dance to the tune of another piper. Because we are satisfied as a country and as a government that many of the benchmarks that we are measured on have been grossly violated by some of the developed world, especially since the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan. So that telling us as developing countries that we need to do X, Y, and Z, yes, but don't tell us, and you are telling us that on the indices we are way at the bottom, and you who are grossly violating them are still at the top as countries of models for success and for police reform and security reform. Come off of it. We're not going to buy it. And so we don't have secret prisons. We don't have secret trials. You know, yes, there are encounters with criminals where there'll always be the judgment issue. Did the police use their weapons correctly or not, according to the protocol? And that will have to be subjected to the usual parameters of scrutiny, whether it's the police complaints authority, whether it's the Office of Professional Responsibility of the police force, whether it is the courts. Those are then the ways in which they will be judged. Did the policeman make an error of judgment? Did he abuse power? Or did he, under the circumstances, do what is correct? And we will stand by that all the time. But we are not going to be told a number of issues as a country. We have capital punishment still in Guyana, but we have not hung anybody from 1998. There is capital row and death row, and because of the crime wave, there are many of us who don't like capital punishment. But after the 2002 crime wave, the population out there doesn't want to hear anything about the removal of capital punishment. And if we were to listen to some of the more conservative elements in our country, we should hang people. We have not done that either. So, and we have put in our what you call a denunciation in the ICCPR, that we have not abolished capital punishment. So they are going to, those are the benchmarks in terms of the UN Human Rights Treaty. They will raise issues with us. We report to the Human Rights Treaty bodies. We are open to scrutiny. And we have obligations there which we will implement as far as we can, whether it is financial or other constraints. But the police force obviously are coming along in a variety of ways. As I said, the reforms have to look at the organizational structure of the police form, the systems, the protocols. A number of issues have to be modernized. The number of ranks have to be reduced. The number of divisions increased based on as the society develops and as we have more economic activity in regions which never had much going on, the security forces and the police have to move. With the donor community in the justice sector project, the issue of penal reform, prison reform, is a critical component. However, the donor community will not listen, do not want to support at all any funds being used for creating new prisons or modern prisons. So we have very old prisons, which, if we look at our balance sheet, do we build a new maximum security prison, which we need, of billions of dollars, or do we provide water and housing and roads and electricity to our people? It's only so much money we have. Mm-hmm. We're not a rich country. And so whilst we've moved from being a poor, low-income country to a low-middle-income country, and we're proud of that, we still have limitations. So that even in the IDB project for justice sector, they refused to give us any money that would enhance, improve the lockups in the police stations that we're doing, that we're modernizing. So we have to use our money for that. So they did not want to hear. So the lockups are bad. Not the Ritz, I can tell you that, having been locked up in the good old days. That there is no funding that's going to come from any donor agency for that. But the reason why we have at any one time 1,600 prisoners in the prisons in Guyana. Mm-hmm. Women are very 50-something. In our prisons, and the majority of our prisoners are foreigners, female prisoners, majority with drugs. And a few South Africans every now and again, I should tell you. We've had Italians, Chileans, in my time, I remember, there was South African, both male and female, all drugs, all drug-related.
Four Canadians recently.
So that... The foreign population in the prison is very small, but all drugs, all. So that of that 1,600 that are in prison at any one day, approximately 500 are remand. So if we can improve the justice sector and the timeliness of the cases in the magistrate court and the high court and so on, we can reduce the pressure on the present prisons that we have. We can improve that, reduce that amount, and so forth. So I've given you a mouthful. I hope I haven't forgotten anything. Ah, I did forget one thing. That is that part of the process, too, we created what was called a National Commission on Law and Order. It's a big body. We put every Tom, Dick, and Harry on it, and that is that. The chairman is the Minister of Home Affairs. The terms of reference were approved by Cabinet, and it allows to make recommendations. It's an advisory body to the President, actually, and it brings forth recommendations. It can have community outreaches. It can do surveys. It can do research. Who are the bodies on it? The parliamentary political parties are invited to have a representative on it each. The private sector... The three religious official religions, Christian, Hindu, Muslim, the community policing group, which has a national executive of all the community policing groups, they meet annually and they elect an executive, so that body is represented. Then you have the Attorney General's Office, the Ministry of Human Services sit on it. The Commissioner of Police, representative of the Army, representative of the prison, representative of fire. Oh, and I forgot the trade union movement. They have representative. So it's a very broad-based body, and in my period we started looking at domestic violence, road safety, organized crime, and narco trade. Those were the four themes that we ran on in the period when it was set up in 2005 November to 2006 August. And Minister Rohi continues with that work today. So that was an attempt to say, okay, look, this issue requires a coming together of a variety of entities to examine the issues and to say to the government, here are some things you could do. We also had in that period, again, based on social and political stability, meetings with the private sector bodies to look at, because they were part of the victims. Their businesses were being attacked. Their workers and their bosses or owners were being shot, some killed, and stuff like that. So that they had many concerns because their businesses were being affected, their security, etc. And so there were several conferences, workshops, in which the private sector was very much a part of it, putting forward recommendations to the government, some of which were, for example, trying to get the business sector to recognize electronic transactions for payments and for checks to be used instead of cash. Because in those days, not long ago, you went to buy, you're building a house, you went to buy materials, you walk with $500,000 cash on you, $1 million cash on you. Part of it is that that's how culturally our people are now developing a trust in the banking sector. Mm-hmm. The traditional culture of our people is you keep your money home, put it under the mattress, you bury it in the backyard. We are rural societies. You know, the majority of people are rural. These are traditions. So you have your jewelry, your gold, and the stuff that you wear for your weddings and our tradition of dowries and stuff like that. You keep it at home, mm-hmm. you know, so that you can give your daughter-in-law you can wear it for a wedding and stuff like that. And so they were very vulnerable. To try to get those people to open bank accounts was a big issue. So a campaign was on to get people to open bank accounts so that they could, you know, transact. But then you found that business entities weren't accepting checks. And not all of them had these, the ATM debit card arrangements. Mm-hmm. So this was we discovered these little interventions that could reduce vulnerability of people, to the criminals. And those were little things that were done. The banks didn't mind because it made more people bank. And what we did in the public service, we realized our vulnerability because every month when you pay public servants, each ministry would go to the bank, clear a $5 million check, walk with $5 million cash to the ministry, and workers would come from all over that ministry to be paid. So we changed that, and that encouraged all workers in the public sector to open a bank account, and then all the money was transferred into their bank account, and only temporary or casual workers or weekly workers were paid cash. And this was like a very small percent in each ministry. So that because it was always a view at one time, you know, geez, they could come in here and attack a ministry on payday. Those were small interventions and it developed an interesting culture because then people realized, oh, my bank account. Because the tendency, if you walk with your cash, your salary, mm-hmm. you use it more mm-hmm. than if you have to keep going to the ATM to get money out. And that developed a little saving culture for our people. At first it was resisted. Yeah. And we had to try to get the banks to be more efficient because when we started doing it, it led to banking day in the parliament. In the banks were horrendous because there were hundreds of people lining up. Mm-hmm. But they've become more efficient in that and stuff like that. So I've talked a lot. I hope all of that was useful.
Extremely useful. I know that you have many demands on your time, so I do appreciate you giving me so much of your afternoon.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, man.